The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to former Rolling Stone associate editor Robert Greenfield, author of three histories of the Rolling Stones. The latest is Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile. Stick around. Maybe Greenfield will finally put that whole sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing in some sort of perspective for us civilians. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience that, when stoned, can't tell Mick from Keith in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. If you're going to write a book about the Rolling Stones at this point in their history, you damn well better have something unique to say. Because if you search the Rolling Stones on Amazon.com under books, it brings up, I'm not kidding, 17,812 results, literally. There are many duplicates, of course, and a lot of books that only mention the Stones, but still. Oh, and in my humble opinion, after Keith Richards wrote his own memoir, Life, I believe you could almost throw out everything that had been written before it about Keith. But not only was Keith's voice compelling and authoritative, it was an absolutely fascinating read from a voice you never thought you'd hear. All of which brings us to former Rolling Stone magazine associate editor in London, Robert Greenfield. He wrote two previous books about the world's most dangerous band, 1974's well-received STP, A Journey Through America with the Rolling Stones, and 2006's, well, not quite as well-reviewed, Exile on Main Street, A Season in Hell with the Rolling Stones. So Greenfield and rock fans could have gone either way with his latest up-close and personal report, Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile. I am happy to report that the author has added several new colors to what we see of the band coming in the aftermath of Life. Goodbye is a sometimes cheeky behind-the-scenes report on what the band imagined to be its last tour of England before relocating to tax exile in France. And Greenfield tells the story in two voices, the 25-year-old sole journalist on the road with the band, as well as the 60-something eligible probably for Social Security that he is now. If you love the Stones, you'll find this tale irresistible. And Robert Greenfield, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you. I was a little hesitant when I mentioned the Social Security. I hope you weren't offended.
No, I'd get that check every month.
Okay. Well, I did the math that you were 25 when you were covering the band, and I don't need to point out the exact number I came up with, but I figured Social Security was probably about right.
That's right.
Okay. So I cannot tell you a lie. The one-time rock critic in me from the 80s loves a really good behind-the-scenes rock and roll tale. It's always, aha, so that's what they were up to behind the scenes. I assume that because you're still doing this, you have that same kind of interest.
Well, you know, people have asked why I wrote this book, and the answer is very simple, which is, as you said, not only was I the only writer, journalist, reporter on that tour, on that particular tour, but the tour itself represents the end of the first chapter of the Rolling Stones' career. It's the last time ever where they get on trains, public trains. There's no security, no backstage passes, no laminates, no sound checks, no rehearsals. They are playing two shows a night in decrepit town halls all over England, places that by all rights should have fallen down 100 years before they got there. And it was never again the way it was back then. And I realized that as the only person who was there, and the saving grace in all of this, for those who are hoarders, was that I had my two spiral-bound notebooks that I had filled during the tour. And as I write in the book, this was very much the era of Tom Wolfe, the new journalism, where you hung out, man. And I didn't do interviews. When I got on the train at King's Cross to accompany the band to Newcastle, where they did the first two shows, no one knew who I was. In retrospect, I realized that Mick Jagger had to have known. He had to have approved of having a writer from Rolling Stone magazine on the tour. But no one introduced me to anybody. No one said, hey, this guy is here to write about the tour. So there was no level of caution. There was no separation. As far as they knew, because this was the way I looked back then, I could have been a roadie. There were always people around them that they had not met before on tour. I could have been a PR person. And so somebody said to me that it's really interesting that the book doesn't begin with Mick and Keith. The book begins with Nicky Hopkins, and who was their great piano player at that time, who I consider the greatest rock and roll session piano, the greatest rock and roll piano player ever, I believe. And Nicky was accessible. Nicky was a sweetheart. He was the first person I spoke to because he was easy to talk to. He didn't know who I was or what I was doing there either. And, you know, as the tour progressed, it's not as though I formed, you know, lasting relationships with them on this tour. I never exchanged a single word with Keith Richards throughout the 10 days that we were on the road together. But then, God love him, Keith Richards never arrived on time for a single show.
Right. Well, there's two, and I want to come back in a minute to how you landed that gig of being the sole journalist. But it's interesting, there's two moments in the book where you first encounter Mick and Keith separately in terms of one-on-one. Mick takes you aside, and well, I don't know if he took you aside, but he basically says, "You haven't written a goddamn thing down. You're not a journalist." And he really challenged you with that. And then the other one was you got assigned after the tour by Rolling Stone,
right,
to go to Paris or somewhere in France. After you were going to cover the Cannes Film Festival, and then you were going to do a one-on-one,
right,
with Keith, and you went to Keith's house before the film festival to just say hi and not thinking he even knew who you were, and he was like, Bob Greenfield, so good to see you. I mean, those are great moments. Those are worth the book.
Thank you. The incident with Mick, bizarrely enough, or not bizarrely, knowing Mick, because what I again came to realize now is that because he did know who I was, he granted me several audiences. I didn't interview. I never took notes where anyone could see me. I spent a good deal of the tour in some of the most atrocious and freezing cold lavatories in England, which if anyone lived in England at that period of time, you know how bad they smelled. And that's where I would write down everything I had just seen and heard the Stones say. I didn't want anyone to see me taking notes. I didn't want to, you know, the Heisenberg principle. I didn't want to displace the reality as though I could have. I mean, they were going to, I didn't know that then. I was 25 and a half, but that was the way I operated. And I'll go to Keith first in terms of the order in which I encountered them. The only shared experience I had with Keith Richards on the 1971, it was March 1971, farewell tour of England. And the reason it was a farewell tour was that after being very famous on both sides of the Atlantic for 5 years, the Stones were completely broke, which is not something people can understand now, but they had been managed by Alan Klein, who was managing the Beatles at the same time. He then retained the copyright to songs. They had no idea what he was doing with their money. They owed a fantastic amount of money to the Inland Revenue, which is the IRS in England, and they were in like a 90% tax bracket. So they had brought in a new financial advisor, Prince Rupert Lowenstein, who died just recently, and the way they were going to survive was to leave England and no longer pay English taxes on a full-time basis. They chose to go to the south of France, not a bad move, but it was truly the beginning of exile for them, because, again, at this stage of their lives and careers, yes, they had been to America. Yes, they had toured all over Europe, but they were completely English. It's hard to understand now how separate and different England was back then. Very isolated, very much an enclosed society that, I mean, you know, Keith later said to me that when we went to Newcastle and Manchester, those cities looked exactly as they had during the Depression. It was still fairly grim in England. Swinging London had come and gone. There had been flower power and LSD in England. But the basic nature of English society was pretty much the way it was. It was utterly class-oriented. The working class was still working class. And there wasn't a lot of money to be made there. And the Stones, however, by this point, had become a very integral part of English culture. They were there. These are our boys, bad as they may be. The Beatles had just broken up, which I think lends more poignancy to this tour. Many of the people who came to see these shows were kind of reliving their teenage past. They were now older. They were coming to see this band that they love. So, having gone off on a tangent, my first and only interaction with Keith occurred in Brighton, England, a seaside town where people have traditionally gone from London, often for the day, to enjoy the, Brighton Rock, a Graham Greene novel, as well as a candy confectioner. Keith was late, as always. He was traveling with Anita Pallenberg, well-known actress who was in Performance, their young son Marlon, and Graham Parsons. Late of the birds.
And the dog, Boogie.
And Boogie, and the great dog, Boogie, who was involved in another psychotic incident on a plane flying back from Glasgow. We can talk about that later if you'd like. So we got to this awful discotheque in Brighton called the Big Apple. I am from New York, but I don't know why the Big Apple was located in Brighton, England. And we got downstairs to go into the dressing room. It was very much we. I'm traveling with the band. I'm one of them, in my mind at least. And the dressing room is locked. Okay, you would think this is not a major issue. But when Keith Richards is involved, and he's got his young child, his son is with him, and Marlon's in Keith's arm, and Marlon is coughing occasionally as a young child. Anyway, it immediately becomes a Dickensian drama of major proportions. Keith is just spouting off about the nerve of these people. How dare they? You know, the Stones don't stand in dread. They send people to go find the promoter, get the keys. Nothing is happening. And the next thing I know, Keith and I are working on the door of the dressing room. He's got a knife, because be warned, Keith almost always has a knife, okay? He goes nowhere without it. And I don't know what I'm using. It might have been a very hippie Swiss Army knife. It might have been a metal comb. We take the hinges off the door. We throw the door on the floor, and the band walks in. And 2 seconds later, the promoter shows up, and like, this is, you know, rock and roll vandalism. Nobody knows what happened. The door was lying there when we arrived, okay, which is the classic Stones paradigm. We are not responsible. We have done nothing wrong. The incident with Mick occurs at the very end of the tour. There were two shows at an incredible venue known as the Roundhouse in London, which was really like the Fillmore. It was the hippie underground venue of choice in London. And between shows, Mick, who I said granted me several audiences and could not have been nicer to me throughout the course of the entire tour, just really got in my face and said, well, man, you don't know anything that's happened on this. You haven't taken a single note. And what am I going to do, argue? And, you know, I just stood there and I took it. And then I went back and wrote a piece that appeared in Rolling Stone magazine more than 2 weeks later, which to me really speaks about the way the world operated before we were on Skype together and how long the lag time. It was big news in America. Oh, my God. Here's a report of this tour. It was the first that anyone had actually heard about it. But I was certain that my time with the band was over. Jagger had basically told me to piss off, as the English are very good at doing. And then I continued working on other stories. I went to Belfast, hung out with the IRA. I went to Paris. I interviewed a representative of the North Vietnamese delegation to the Paris peace talks. The Vietnam War was still raging, and was then notified that, yes, I had been selected, for reasons that I had no idea what they were, to do the Rolling Stone interview with Keith Richards. Rolling Stone interview back then was a very big deal. The person who you interviewed appeared on the cover. Most of the issue would be taken up with the interview. And so I did, in fact, journey to Villa Nelcutt, Keith's pleasure dome by the sea in Villa France. And I had no idea. I had never spoken to him. I didn't know if he would know who I was. And he greeted me like a long-lost brother. And now we're in the second section of the book where I end up living with him for 2 weeks, spending another week transcribing this long and very complicated interview that I did with him under, I guess the word would be, unbelievable duress, because Keith, as everyone knows, is not controllable. You can't say to him, okay, we got to sit down now, man, we're not finished. So it was a lot of hanging out in a very, very crazy situation.
Well, all right, so let's go backwards for a minute. It's 1971. The Stones have been together about 9 years, I'm thinking, at this point.
I don't think, well, kind of, yes.
I was kind of thinking in the book that you date back to a time when they appeared on stage. I thought it said 62, if it was 63.
No, that sounds right to me. Yeah.
All right. So, and the Beatles have just broken up. How is it that the Stones in London are able to tour with only one journalist wanting to go with them? How did you wind up being the guy on this tour? I mean, did somebody send you there thinking, let's just screw with the young kid?
No. The second question is a lot easier to ask than the first. The fact that no one saw them off at the station is still incredible to me. No streaming fans, no media. I make the point in the book that the next morning in Newcastle, when we got up to get in cars and drive to Manchester, there were several reporters there then in the lobby, and Mick came walking out dressed as only Mick was dressed back then. And one reporter said to the other, is that him then? Is that Jagger? In other words, we're still talking about a society where the split between the straight world and the underground was immense. Okay. It's not like England had turned on and everybody was groovy. People were still who they were. Now, the second question is a lot easier. What was remarkable about living and working in London then was how small the music business was. Everybody truly did know one another. People were far more relaxed than they had ever been in New York when I was trying to break into rock journalism. And very simply, I worked for someone who became my lifelong friend named Andrew Bailey, who was the head of the London Bureau. And I said to him, you know, I want to go on this tour. I think it's a good story. I want to hang out with the band, see what happens. And he then, because he was the fixer, it was good cop, bad cop stuff. And he was much more savvy than I was and had been in the music business a lot longer, had worked for Variety and was very savvy. We had lunch with Jo Bergman, who was the woman who then ran the Stones office. I was truly an out-and-out hippie. There's a picture of me in the book. I have long hair. I have a beard. I never wore anything but jeans and work shirts. And I think, I don't know, she just either took pity on me. It also had to do with the fact that if you worked for Rolling Stone then, you were part of the culture. Mm-hmm. And that was the venue through which all the bands in England communicated with their audience in America. What I didn't know, because I was clueless, Stones had, of course, just gotten themselves out of Decca. After being pursued for over a year by Ahmet Erdogan, about whom I wrote in The Last Sultan, The Life and Times of Ahmet Erdogan, they had signed with Atlantic. Marshall Chess, the son of Leonard Chess of Chess Records in Chicago, was the head of Rolling Stones Records. They finally had their own label. They had completed Sticky Fingers, but it was not as though this tour was promoting the album. The insanity of the way it was back then was that they had to leave England by a certain date, so they had to tour before then. The album wasn't out. Every night, I stood on stage at the piano, and they performed Bitch, Brown Sugar, Wild Horses. No one had ever heard these songs. They never mentioned that they were on the new album. They never talked to me. Oh, they did. Marshall Chess talked to me about the album, gave me the running order of songs, which then was completely revised. But it was not as though they were using me to promote the coming product. Mm-hmm. It just was a time when this sensibility didn't exist. And, you know, what I hope comes through in the book was how much fun it was to be on the tour with them in England.
Absolutely. And but the other thing I'm wondering is, okay, so the Beatles have just broken up, and it would seem to me that with that happening, of course, there's still a lot of press about the Beatles and the breakup and why it happened, and blame Yoko.
Yeah.
But also, I would think that attention would have, that swell of attention would then switch to, okay, well, we don't have them. Well, let's go focus on the Rolling Stones. They've got, Keith has Anita and Mick has Bianca. They're battling. So, what was the atmosphere like post-Beatles and being out there? I mean, were they even talking? This is something I didn't entirely get from the book, from the first half anyway, is was there much discussion from anyone around them about the Beatles? I mean, they obviously knew the Beatles. They were involved in some ways over the years with the Beatles. Were they talking about, was anyone saying, you know, that could be us?
No, it's a great question. Mick at one point, again in Newcastle, was asked by this very straight reporter, well, the Beatles have broken up. Oh, no, what he said was, someone in Rolling Stone said the Rolling Stones have always followed the Beatles. The Beatles have broken up. Are you breaking up too? And Mick, who is a genius at doing this kind of stuff, Charlie Watts was creeping around the outside of the media circle by which Mick and this interviewer were surrounded. And Mick said, Charlie, are we breaking up then? Are we done? You know? And Charlie was just like, you know, could have cared less about the interview and or the question. And Mick said, no, we're not done. Of course, they needed the money. But, I mean, your question is really well taken. The only answer I could give is that The Who were still up and about. Led Zeppelin was coming big, very strong, possibly even stronger in America at that point than they were in England. The business itself was still so vibrant. There were so many. Traffic was still playing. I mean, I saw Traffic at the London School of Furniture. I put that up there with one of the more bizarre, and they were beyond belief. They were incredible, okay? My point being that one of the questions I'm also asked is why these halls held at most 2,000 people, mm-hmm. okay? Why did the Stones play these venues? Well, these were the only venues that were available for, this is where everybody played. This is where The Who would play. And the other point being that in a city like Newcastle, in a city like Manchester, two shows, 4,000 people were as many people as wanted to see the Stones. It's very hard to go back and, you know, before it exploded. Now, the next time the Stones played London, a few years later, it was enormous. They were at some huge venue with screens, and it had already changed that rapidly in the ensuing years. And after the second part of the book, which is about the south of France and surviving living in Villa Nelcut, I then went on the 1972 American tour. Now, the American tour, I was also in L.A. when they completed mixing of Exile on Main Street, and then the book concludes in Jamaica, where they were recording Goat's Head Soup. When they went on the American tour, which was only 15 months, after the English tour, it bore no relationship whatsoever to what had come before. It was insane. It was out of control. They performed in 18 and 20,000 seat hockey arenas. The pressure, the money, that's the difference. That was the difference then between America and England. And whenever the Stones would come to America, as they did in 1969 at Altamont, they would crystallize whatever insanity was going on in the country. The Stones were an excuse, as they had been in Europe. I think what people don't really realize is that long before I toured with them, when the Stones toured in Europe in the late 60s, there was revolution in the streets. Not political revolution, rock and roll insanity. Like, let's destroy this. Let's cops on horseback and throwing bombs and just madness in Germany, in the Netherlands, and Belgium, in places that you would think, oh, well, this is civilized. The Stones always brought this craziness out. And as I point out in the book, it was one of the reasons they never really took full responsibility for Altamont. Mm. They had seen all this kind of stuff before. And as far as they were concerned, what went on in the audience or in the hall, what could they do? Their job was to play music.
Mm. Well, I want to go a little off a little off the topic for a second. It's still a Rolling Stone question, but there was one little anecdote about your time on the tour that cracked me up. And it has nothing to do with music. I think it was Charlie Watts you were talking to. He was watching television, and he was watching Doctor Who.
Doctor Who.
In 1971, and you asked, you know, can you fill me in? Can you bring me up to date? And you, I mean, for there's a ton of Doctor Who fans, including my daughter.
Okay.
Can you just recount that?
Yeah, I mean, there were so many things in England that were not in America. I mean, great things, you know, English football being one of them, you know. But Doctor Who, absolutely, even by that point, England was cult. I mean, people were insane for Doctor Who. And we were in, it will come to me. It was the Empire. We were in Liverpool. There you go. And, okay, your point, to go back to your point before. I found myself in Liverpool. I had spent my adolescence in Brooklyn watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan with my parents, like every other kid in America. In Liverpool, it never occurred to me to, I could have walked and gone to the Cavern Club just to see it, okay?
Right.
But the Stones thing was so enveloping that there was no leaving the bubble of the tour. So that day, Keith was extraordinarily late. He, he missed the first plane. The second plane broke down. Then he got on then he must have driven because he would never have gotten on the train. Keith was not about to take trains. And no one knew where he was. And people were kind of authentically freaked out. No Keith, no show. Unlike Brian Jones, who was only 2 years dead at that point, less than 2 years dead. Brian Jones had missed several shows in England and in America. The band could play without Brian. They could not play without Keith. So everybody was freaked out. This was the subject of the day. And we were in Marshall Chess's suite in this very old hotel. And killing time, the other thing that struck me is how much time you spend killing time when you're on the road. Most of the time, you're not on stage. You're waiting to go on stage. And Charlie is glued to the telly. He's watching Doctor Who. And he was so lovely back then. He was such a sweet human being, completely approachable. He and Ian Stewart, who was the original piano player in the band, became their roadie because he didn't look like a Rolling Stone, according to Andrew Oldham and Brian Jones, but continued to play piano on this tour. Stu would play on all songs which did not contain what he called Chinese chords.
Right.
I guess they were minors. I don't know. But so here's Charlie. He's watching this show. I've been in England a while, and I say to him, Charlie, hey, can you tell me what's going on here? And he looked at me for a second. He said, no. He threw his hands in the air and said, unless you followed us in the beginning, it's impossible. And he went right back to watching it. And as any hardcore Doctor Who fan knows, can you explain it? No.
And it's the same now. The show's been back on for several years, five seasons, six seasons, eight seasons, whatever it's been. And I know my wife and daughter watch, and you know, periodically I've said, can you? And they're like, no, don't ask.
No,
you know, sit down and watch it with us.
Exactly.
And my daughter tried at one point to have me go back and watch
it. Oh, it's insane. You can't.
There's not that much time left in my life. So the other thing I was wondering about is on 72 you went on the American tour. Did you ever in the subsequent years go out on tour with any other bands?
I have never been on tour with anyone but the Rolling Stones.
Interesting.
And I have not seen the Rolling Stones since, I believe, July 26, 1972, which I think was Mick's 29th birthday.
Well, I saw them in Orlando when they did the Jovan tour, you know, sponsored by Jovan, which was, of course, the big deal at the time. And then, oh, my God, they're sponsored by a fragrance company, corporate sponsors. I'm thinking that was 79-80.
Okay.
It might be around then. And then I know I saw them once or twice since then, which is why the last thing I wanted to ask you about, because I know you need to get to dinner, but
no,
I wondered – actually, there's two things I want to ask you about.
Please.
So let me come to that one last. The first thing is, I got to ask you about Keith's book. Were you as surprised as I was, as other people were, to read the book, and not only to read the book, but to find out that maybe he was paying attention all that time? It's astonishing. It was astonishing to read it.
No, No, my answer is no. I wasn't surprised at all, because if you can be bothered to read the Rolling Stone interview I did with him, he always had a voice. Mm. He always saw things in a very unique way, and I always knew how brilliant he was. And back then, how sensitive, actually, he also was as an artist while living like an outlaw, okay? So the book did not surprise me in the least. James Fox, who worked on the book with Keith for a long time, who's a wonderful writer, I spent a lot of time talking to James and gave him a lot of material that I had, because if you're a friend of Keith's, you want to do everything to help Keith. What I think people should bear in mind when they read that book is that that is the world according to Keith. Not everything in there is accurate. Not everything in there happened the way Keith says it does or did. I know that. But, you know, again, in the very shallow media world that we all live in, I am name-checked in the book, and I'm referred to as the embedded journalist during that period. The book is wonderful because it's like hanging out with Keith. Mm. That's why people love that book.
Right.
And listen, he is so forthcoming in that book about so much stuff that no one else would ever have discussed, okay? But he also skips over entire periods that he now finds very painful, and one of the periods that he skips over is Exile on Main Street, Villa Nelcutt, and the level of drug use that was going on there that summer.
Of course. And, you know, I mean, I make my living actually helping people write their books as a professional co-author. And I know from experience that what always happens, so I was not surprised by Keith doing this, is they all, I mean, that's the benefit of writing your own memoirs, is you just skip the parts you don't want to talk about. It's your book. You do what you want. But I thought it was fascinating to read. And then after finishing it, I was like, okay, I want to read more of this type of book. So I got Pete Townsend's book, I love Townsend. I mean, I think he's a brilliant guy. He's a musician. But oh my God, he's so full of himself. And I don't think I've gotten past, like, think I've gotten to 1960 yet. It's just
Here's the reason. I am also a co-author. I co-authored Bill Graham's book, Bill Graham Presents My Life Inside Rockin' Out. I co-authored Burt Bacharach's book, Anyone Who Had a Heart, My Life in Music. Pete Townsend wrote his own book. And now, Pete Townsend, I consider to be the most brilliant talker in rock and roll. There's no one. He's never given a bad interview in his life. He's fascinating. But he sat down to write it. He got into the other part of his brain, the writing brain, and the great vibrancy that you get when you talk to him. I don't even hear his voice on the page. So I'm now putting out a want ad. If there are any rock stars left who would like their voice on the page, just give me a shout.
Right. And if Robert's not available, call me.
Right. Yeah. Dude, between us.
We'll talk. All right. So that brings me to my last question.
Go ahead.
And then you can go and have a meal. So
all right.
I don't usually ask people this. I've had a whole bunch of other writers from Rolling Stone over the years who've been on the show, and I don't think I've asked them this. David Wilde, Park Peterbaugh. I actually wrote it down so I wouldn't forget. Ben Fong Torres, Rob Tannenbaum. Anthony DeCurtis is coming up in a couple of weeks.
Great.
But I got to know, three top Rolling Stone songs from you.
I hate making lists, you know, I really do. And I would answer that question by saying to you that since I have left the world of the Rolling Stones, I have come to appreciate how much good music Keith and Mick have written together. I think what gets overlooked when people talk and think about the Stones, probably because of Mick's onstage persona and how great he still is on stage, is how many really good songs they've written together. I mean, if you go back to Beggar's Banquet, which represents the... I'll answer the question in a very, not licentious, but very deceitful manner, which is, here's what I would say. Possibly the three greatest back-to-back-to-back rock albums ever made are, in my mind, Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, and Sticky Fingers. I'm leaving out what everybody under the age of 35 considers to be their masterpiece, Exile on Main Street. So if you want to add that on, I think you'll find that in those albums, there are so many incredible songs, that many of which were overlooked at the time, There are so many different genres of music. I don't think you can name a band that has played rock, blues, and what is really country and western, the way the Stones have. They are so mutable. And this is, I think, well, it's because of both Mick and Keith, both of whom are music scholars. The Rolling Stones begin because Mick Jagger is holding One Dozen Berries by Chuck Berry on the Dartford train platform when Keith bumps into him. It's two nerded out music fanatics saying, oh, wow, man, you've got that record. How did you get it? You know? So I wonder if this will ever happen again. If in the world we live in, and there's so much music now in the past, in the present, so much more coming, if there'll ever be two people like them who have, and again, these are white boys in England who are obsessed with the blues, and then Brian Jones, obsessed with the blues, playing slide guitar like Elmore James, they're bringing to bear on this new form of music, rock and roll. They're bringing all this experience that they've gained by listening to actually the masters who created what became rock and roll by playing the blues. And then, you know, basically Graham Parsons does a lot here to get Keith into country, teaches him the various country styles. This is Bakersfield. This is this. This is that. He educates him to that. You know, I really think Keith wrote his book so that people would know about his music and what it was that he did in the Rolling Stones, aside from playing guitar on stage. Without Keith, there is no band. Without Mick, there is no band. And again, to close on this on some level, you know, we would not be talking about them had they not survived. This is the ultimate test of, you know, time is the ultimate test of your talent, your ability, your perseverance. And of all the bands that were alive and playing back then, they're the one that still consists in its closest original form. Mick and Keith and Charlie are the Rolling Stones. The bass player can come and go. The horns can come and go. They didn't need backup singers on the English tour. They need them now. But as the great Bill Graham would have said, if they weren't any good, nobody would come see them. And they're still selling a lot of tickets. Mm,
absolutely. All right. So, is this it? Have you told your last Stone story, or is there more?
I'll give you another question or more.
I'm just wondering. I mean, is there another book?
I see. Well, yeah. The title is "Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye," and I thought, well, that's pretty resonant because it is time that I said goodbye to the Rolling Stones. I think three books about the Rolling Stones is more than enough. And as soon as I finished writing Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, someone got in touch with me who had purchased all of the original photographs for Beggar's Banquet. Hmm. These are the astonishing color photographs of them dressed in medieval outfits. If anyone's ever seen these, they look like Flemish paintings. They're little works of art. They're so astonishing. And so I then agreed, why would I say no? I then agreed to write the text for a book that's going to be called Men of Wealth and Fame. Oh. And it's really interesting to look at Beggar's Banquet because it represents the comeback. The Stones were quote-unquote dead in the water after their Satanic Majesties. The album was roundly panned. Everybody thought they were trying to emulate Sgt. Pepper. It didn't sell that much, but, you know, what the history of this band is, they just never quit. And they find ways to come back that defy... It's not understandable on many levels. This is a rock band that's been playing for 52 years. Mm-hmm. Say no more.
Yeah. All right. Well, folks, listen. You can find Robert Greenfield's third, You Are There, History of the Rolling Stones, Anytime We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price right here at MrMedia.com. If you've watched the show before, you know, if you're watching this on MrMedia.com, somewhere down there underneath Robert and I is a copy of the book, or some of his other books will be there as well. If you want it, you can click on it right now. You can download it, get it instantly to your e-book reader, or you can have it sent to you You know, if they're using drones by the time you see this, you can probably get it in 30 minutes or less, kind of like a pizza. Otherwise, you know, it's eBay that can get it. It's what's the name? Amazon. Amazon can get it to you, you know, overnight, within 2 days at worst. So order it there. Robert, or Bob, sorry, do you use a website, Facebook, Twitter? Are you online anywhere people can find you?
I'm speaking to you.
This is it.
This is about it.
All right.
Of my media.
All right.
My media capabilities.
Fair enough. Well, Robert Greenfield, Bob Greenfield, it was a pleasure to talk to you. It's a fascinating book to read, and thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media.
Anytime. Thank you so much for having me.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk, and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
Oh, yeah. Hey, these are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot.
Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights. Just a Minute with Joe Ardinger.
Like most people living in California, I am deluding myself that I have the flu. But we all know it's really radiation from Fukushima. Or just the flu.
To hear the rest of this minute, to sample Joe's other minutes, and to subscribe to his newest ones, visit RealmNetwork.com. That's RELMNetwork.com. Just a Minute with Joe Ardinger, another great Realm Network production. Wednesday afternoons, right here on the Realm Network.
The preceding presentation was brought to you by the Realm Network.